Good evening and welcome. It's my pleasure tonight to welcome everybody back to our fifth of our call-in series. Actually, it's our halfway mark. My name is Perry Hoffman, and I'm president of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. We're very pleased tonight to have Dr. Richard Hirsch, who is a longtime friend of our organization and who's done a lot of things with us. He's Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry, Associate Director of the Intensive Outpatient Program in the Department of Psychiatry at New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York. So I turn the phone over to Dr. Hirsch, who will tell you a little bit more about himself, and then we'll begin his presentation. And again, for those of you who do not have the handouts, please go on our website, borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com, and you can download them off the site. Thank you. Richard.
Great. Thanks so much, Perry. So happy to be talking tonight about a borderline personality disorder informing patients and families. As Perry said, I'm an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University and the associate director of the intensive outpatient program at the Columbia University Medical Center and also faculty at the Columbia Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. Want to talk tonight about the issue of disclosing diagnosis. And I think I'm going to start with clinical situation that actually happened at our program a number of months ago and in so many ways underscores some of the points that I hope to get across today. So I work with residents. My resident and I saw a young woman who had moved to New York City came from out of state and had, she was 18 and had been given a different diagnosis over the two or three years before we first saw her. She was seen by a psychotherapist and seen monthly by a psychiatrist and had a number of different symptoms and received a number of different diagnoses in different diagnostic categories. She self-injured her, by picking at herself and was given a diagnosis for that. In the obsessive-compulsive disorder realm, she was obsessive-compulsive disorder spectrum. She had mood instability and was given a depression diagnosis for that. She was a cannabis abuser and was given cannabis abuse diagnosis. And when we saw her for the first time, my resident and I started to talk about whether all the different symptoms she was presenting might be consistent with one diagnosis, which was borderline personality disorder. Our first order of business, we saw this patient, we got information from her family, spoke to her outside treaters, and really interestingly, neither her psychiatrist nor her therapist had ever thought of that diagnosis. So I'm going to start with my slides and get back to that story because it underscores some of the issues, barriers regarding giving information about the diagnosis of BPD to patients and families. So we'll start with some of the basic facts about BPD is that it's a common psychiatric diagnosis, different estimations, but I think most people consider between 1% and 2% of the general population, much significantly higher in all or most clinical settings. So 1% is a big number. Schizophrenia, which is a very important illness in for psychiatrists, and is also about 1%. So it just gives you some idea the same rate of prevalence in the population. BPD, as I mentioned, also is disproportionately represented in inpatient and outpatient psychiatric treatment centers. So we would expect to see patients with BPD come to our outpatient clinic. It's been estimated that 15 to 25% of patients in outpatient psychiatric settings are have BPD. We know that BPD can cause significant distress in the lives of patients and families, and it's been our clinical experience that the diagnosis of BPD is often withheld from patients and families. So those are some of the pieces of information that you know, we start this discussion at. It's common. It's disproportionately represented in clinical settings. It causes a lot of harm, and a lot of individuals with BPD and their families don't know that they have that diagnosis. So what are some of the factors that might be behind this situation? Well, it could be that the diagnosis of BPD can be difficult to make. I think it certainly is considered that for many clinicians. Another issue could be that there are often co-occurring diagnoses that can complicate the accurate diagnosis of BPD. This is not uncommon in psychiatry, but it's an issue that clinicians often bring up when discussing the diagnosis of making the diagnosis of BPD. A resident of mine who recently rotated off the inpatient service told me that she was told that it wasn't appropriate to make an access to a personality disorder diagnosis before all access 1 disorders had been treated and remitted. Of course, this is not really very realistic when we know that BPD, for example, and other personality disorders, but we're talking about BPD tonight, are often co-occurring with many access 1 disorders, mood disorders, eating disorders, substance abuse disorders. So that bit of information that resident got, I think, can be counterproductive. We know that insufficient history can complicate an accurate diagnosis of BPD. For psychiatrists who are seeing patients in high-volume practices and don't really get a chance to get a longitudinal history, meaning a history over many years with all the details, that can be a problem in making an accurate diagnosis of BPD. But it's also been my clinical experience that even when clinicians feel that they have made an accurate diagnosis of BPD, that they know it, they often withhold the diagnosis from patients and family. So there are barriers to making an accurate diagnosis, but sometimes even when an accurate diagnosis is made, it is withheld. So why would that be? If we look back at the history of disclosing diagnoses to patients, non-disclosure of serious illness was once really common in all of medicine. But over the last decades, that's really changed, and now disclosure is considered standard practice. So, for example, in oncology with cancer diagnoses, in the past, those diagnoses were withheld from patients. Now it's almost universal that patients are educated about their diagnoses, and, of course, families as well. Similarly, there's now a widespread disclosure of a schizophrenia diagnosis for patients that was once withheld. And there are reasons for disclosure in medicine, and they include education, reduction of stigma, and encouraging autonomy. So over the years in medicine, things have changed. In psychiatry, things have changed. We're still at a point where there are barriers to diagnosis of a borderline personality disorder diagnosis, although organizations like NEABPD and NAMI are helpful in turning this particular tide. So disclosing the BPD diagnosis, why would a clinician not disclose a diagnosis? Well, there are questions about the validity of the BPD diagnosis. And in my experience, I feel like we get this from all sides. So I practice general psychiatry. I sometimes hear from psychiatrists who are mostly interested in pharmacology that they see BPD as primarily some kind of mood disorder. So there's a question about the validity from that perspective. Then I often earn discussions with psychotherapists, maybe who have a psychodynamic or psychoanalytic background, and they might say that they don't even think about personality disorders when they make a diagnosis, that it's not helpful to them. So there are questions about validity really from a number of different groups of clinicians. There's a concern that a BPD diagnosis is unduly stigmatizing. And then there are what we call transference, countertransference paradigms, which mean basically my observation has been that some clinicians worry that patients are going to be angry if they convey that diagnosis, or they'll feel hurt, or they'll worry that conveying the diagnosis will make a patient more suicidal, especially if that's an active issue. There are the questions about the validity of the borderline diagnosis, I think, are part of some of the difficulties with disclosing BPD diagnosis to patients and families. Some of the concerns people have are that it's potentially difficult to distinguish BPD from other diagnoses, that the diagnosis may be invalid because by current DSM standards, there's so many different combinations of symptoms, it can look so different. And as I noted, that there's frequent co-occurrence with Axis 1 and other Axis 2 diagnoses. One of the interesting things about the assessment for borderline personality disorder is that some of the prejudices that clinicians might have, some of the resistance they might have to make the diagnosis has been underscored in research projects. For example, it's been observed that there's a higher yield for Axis 2 diagnoses in research settings when, rather than a free-form interview at the time of an initial appointment, a very specific structured interview is required because it's for a research protocol. It's been noted that there's a higher yield for Axis 2 diagnoses when clinicians use structured interviews in addition to standard clinical exams. So sometimes there's a possibility that clinicians might be avoiding asking questions which could yield a BPD diagnosis. But when their hands are forced, for example, with a structured interview, the yield is higher. So when talking with clinicians about whether or not they feel comfortable disclosing to a patient or family, for example, bringing this up with the kind of patient that I described at the beginning, a young college student, some of the issues that come up have to do with stigma. And it's clear that BPD symptoms can be frightening to and frustrating for clinicians. And it may be easier for clinicians to make a diagnosis they feel more comfortable treating. Clinicians in the past, I think it's fair to say, had misused the BPD diagnosis, and it had become a pejorative term for individuals, patients who were provocative, caused clinicians to be angry or confused. And there's the issue of of suicidality. Other diagnoses where suicidality is a prominent symptom, suicidality or anger, for example, are not considered stigmatizing in the same way that a BPD diagnosis is by some clinicians. When I've talked to clinicians about their resistance or concern about disclosing a BPD diagnosis, some other issues of stigma have come up. For example, many clinicians fear that the BPD diagnosis will engender a sense of hopelessness and despair. So they worry that they're burdening patients and families. And I think this is a somewhat outdated way of thinking about the diagnosis, especially given a lot of important recent research findings. There's also the fear that the BPD diagnosis will communicate an environmental and not a biological etiology. And again, I think this is a concern that dates back actually now almost decades, where there was a kind of a division between biologically caused Axis 1 disorders and environmentally caused personality disorders. And I think this is a holdover from thinking that really goes back a number of decades. There's also the fear that the BPD diagnosis will communicate an insensitivity to a trauma history. Clinicians often bring up these points. And just this past week, I met with a group of clinicians who conveyed to me that they were very reluctant to give this diagnosis because they did feel that it was stigmatizing, that it communicated hopelessness and despair, and that they preferred to think of some of the symptoms that individuals with BPD have as related to exclusively to trauma. So in terms of transference and countertransference issues, how the patient feels, how the therapist feels, there are times when avoiding disclosure of the diagnosis can reflect an unusual feeling of closeness or sympathy. For example, clinicians who feel that they have an unusually close relationship with the patient and therefore don't want to convey the diagnosis because it's potentially hurtful, or because they really want to distance themselves because of a mixture of feelings like hatred and fear, and they don't want to grapple with the patients, don't want to disclose the diagnosis, and then grapple with the issues that come from that. Very often, in my experience, when we generate multi-axial diagnoses in psychiatry, we leave Axis 2 empty, or we put what's called deferred, meaning we'll get to that in the future. And I think that reflects a feeling that making and conveying a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder or avoiding doing that somehow is giving patients the benefit of the doubt. And I think it leads to the question is what's the benefit that goes with that? And again, as I had mentioned, there I think is a concern on the part of many clinicians that patients will become rageful or self-destructive, which has not been my clinical experience, and in at least one study that I'm aware of looked at a response to disclosure of the BPD diagnosis. That was not the researcher's findings either. So we've talked about some of the reasons why clinicians might not want to disclose a BPD diagnosis. Now we'll talk a little bit about why clinicians would want to disclose the diagnosis. So this, a young woman patient that I saw last year, she had been treated for a few years. She was symptomatic in different ways. The symptoms she was experiencing were impacting her functioning. They were causing her family a great deal of distress. And her family, who were intelligent and thoughtful and curious people, couldn't understand why she wasn't responding with the standard interventions, supportive psychotherapy or medication, for the purported diagnosis she was given. So when we talk about some of the reasons to disclose a diagnosis, one of the first is patient autonomy. If patients are made aware of the diagnosis, they have more independence. They can make choices. They can learn about the treatments available and really participate in an informed consent procedure. Psychoeducation is another important part. If individuals with BPD and families of those individuals are made aware of the diagnosis, they can then read up. They can go to organizations like NEA BPD or NAMI or get more information. Accurate diagnosis can guide treatment. One of the very familiar complaints that patients' families often have is that they are spending money on treatment for other diagnoses. The patients aren't getting better. The interventions, often medication, have problematic side effects. And with accurate diagnosis, treatment can be set up, including education about what works and what doesn't work. Another point, which is really with every year, as everyone has increasing access to information, one of the reasons to disclose is, what about self-discovery? What about patients who have access to their outpatient charts or their inpatient charts, or read about BPD on the web, or see something on television about it? They'll put two and two together, and what would it mean for a treatment alliance if they come to the treating clinician and say, "You know, I think I have this. Why didn't you ever tell me?" When we talk about patient autonomy, what we're talking about is what's considered standard of care in medicine right now. Patients in all branches of medicine right now are involved in their decision-making. This is a way of respecting patients' values and encouraging self-determination. In New York State, for example, we have the informed consent law. So that guides our decision-making, whether it's recommending psychotherapy or medications or other kinds of interventions. And if patients aren't aware of the diagnosis, they really can't participate fully in an informed consent procedure. So in terms of other reasons for clinicians to disclose a BPD diagnosis, our experience has been that there really can be tremendous relief for individuals when a name is given to their distress. One of the most common and complicating issues, in my experience, in the treatment of BPD is teasing apart the depression and pain of borderline personality disorder and the depression of major depressive disorder or dysthymic disorder. And in many ways, they're very different. and they respond differently to standard interventions. I think a very common clinical experience is for patients and families to come, for example, to our clinic after many years on many different antidepressant regimens. And the treatment of depression, serious major depression, is pretty effective. We have many different antidepressant medications, and a very common scenario will be a patient and family with a my resident and I will contact the pharmacy and get the list of 5 or 10 different medications or medication combinations, and find out that the patient has been taking the medication, compliant, had whatever different side effects that are common, weight gain, sexual side effects, withdrawal-associated symptoms. Even when patients are compliant, they can have a pain and a feeling of a depressed mood that doesn't respond to standard interventions, and it's very frustrating for patients and very frustrating for families. So if the name, if a clinician can name this and to explain the very specific mood disorder symptoms associated with BPD and explain how they're different from major depressive disorder, that can be, I think, very helpful. Clearly, education about any diagnosis, including BPD, has a potential to lead to empowerment and mastery. And this is of great benefit to patients, to feel like they're not in the dark, they can learn about this, there are there's sources of information, and it can be very powerful and potentially very liberating. And of course, we live in a time when there are new treatments and new research specific for BPD. And this is very different, and this is what makes some of the thinking that, to me, I remember from 25 years ago when I was a trainee, feel very outmoded. We have treatments and studies and prospective studies that we didn't have at that time, and it's a very different world, very different from the time that I was training. So when we're talking about psychoeducation, some of the exciting things that we've learned in recent years about BPD impact that. So we have major prospective studies where patients are identified as having BPD and followed, and what we've, one of the take-home messages has been that what I was taught when I was a resident about the enduring nature of personality disorder and the stability of personality disorders may likely not be true for borderline personality disorder. So that's very different. So some of the concern that clinicians might have had that the disorder is stigmatizing, that it could convey hopelessness, is really not consistent now with the data we have from prospective studies. And I think it allows us as clinicians to convey a sense of optimism that is really very new and in some ways very exciting. And I think should really help clinicians feel more comfortable in beginning this conversation with patients and families. Another development in the last decade or a little bit more than that have been the emerging data from treatment studies. So we now have studies that support specific interventions for BPD. So it's many are familiar, some less so, but DBT, TFP, MBT, STEPS, SFT, all evidence-based interventions for BPD. But one of the interesting things about all of those treatment interventions is that discussion of the borderline diagnosis is integrated into those treatments. So that's a critical part of the early steps of all of those interventions. One of the things that I've noticed is that the widespread adaptation of DBT, when you read the Marshall Linehan text, it's very clear that disclosure of the BPD diagnosis is one of the initial steps of the treatment. Even at programs that I've referred to, I've been aware that that's not always done, but it's not necessarily DBT as it could be a skills group or a mindfulness group where that's not necessarily integrated into it. But all of these emerging studies have that. So how, I think, as a clinician, to refer to a DBT skills group or individual DBT group and not to have discussed this in advance is awkward and not helpful to patients. The discussion of the borderline diagnosis is really essential for all of those treatments. So when we're talking about how accurate diagnosis guides treatment, it allows the clinician and the patient and the family to have a shared understanding of the treatment options. It allows for realistic goals for pharmacotherapy and psychotherapy. I think when I go back to this young woman I've been talking about, one of the helpful byproducts of disclosure of the borderline diagnosis for this patient and family was our ability to talk to the patient and her family about the limits of pharmacotherapy. Medications can be useful, but patients and families often, I think, are overpromised benefits from medication in that period before the diagnosis is clarified and conveyed. When we are able to talk to the patient about the borderline diagnosis, what our observations are, and to make recommendations about medication, we can do so informed by the data, which is that there is no medication approved by the Food and Drug Administration for BPD. No medication on its own is going to cure BPD. Medications, when used, should be used judiciously and to be used to be helpful, but to be adjunctive to other core interventions, specifically some kind of psychotherapy, whether it's an individual psychotherapy, a group, psychoeducation group, or something like that. My experience with families that this is one of the most pressing concerns, that families are get very involved in encouraging patients with BPD to be compliant with medication. They have to help them through various different kinds of side effects. I've mentioned some before. And there's a kind of a chronic disappointment that the medications don't address some of the really prominent and troubling core symptoms. So I think disclosure of the diagnosis really allows for that. It also allows for realistic discussion of different psychotherapies. Because we have treatments now that are specific for BPD, it's important to talk to patients and families about the potential benefits from a specific treatment versus generic treatment, often or sometimes by clinicians who don't even understand that that patient might have a personality disorder or borderline personality disorder in particular. So when we talk about the self-discovery of the diagnosis, there's always a risk if a clinician is reluctant to convey the diagnosis that a patient will learn about it in a group, say. Learn about it in a review of their chart. We have very clear laws now that patients are entitled to access to their charts. What would it mean if a patient got his or her chart, saw a borderline diagnosis, either from inpatient or outpatient, and it was something that had never been brought up? Patients, of course, can learn from the internet and can study, can figure this out themselves. As I mentioned, many of the treatments specific for BPD integrate discussion of the diagnosis into one of the early sessions, if not the first session. So what does it mean and to patients? And I've seen this many times. To go to be referred by a clinician to a DBT skills group or to another BPD specific treatment without having had this discussion first. It leads to, I think, a reasonable question on the part of patients, which is, why didn't you tell me? What was so bad about the diagnosis that you couldn't convey it to me? When we talk about disclosing the BPD diagnosis, and again, in my clinical experience, this is something that is very often not done. It is interesting because the APA guidelines for the treatment of borderline personality disorder recommend disclosure of the diagnosis. That's part of the original guidelines when they were released. Again, clinical practice suggests that this is often not done, despite the very clear recommendation on the part of the American Psychiatric Association and their guidelines that be done. The reasons are compelling for making discussion of the diagnosis part of the treatment. And I think one of the important issues that we face or that I see quite a bit is what I think of as a public health issue, which is what does it mean to have a group of patients who we know use a lot of services, inpatient, outpatient, medication, counseling, who don't know their diagnosis? Issue that my hope would be that an accurately made diagnosis conveyed in the context of treatment could lead to psychoeducation, could guide treatment decision making, and could help to avoid unnecessary interventions with significant untoward effects and events, like unnecessary hospitalizations, weight gain, other significant medication side effects. So now, to kind of sum up, I'm going to go back to the story of this young woman, treated for a couple of years in the community, started college in New York, came to visit us, at our program. We saw her over an extended evaluation, talked to her treaters in the community, and sat down with her and got out our DSM and went through the different diagnostic criteria for some of the diagnoses she thought she had, which we weren't so sure about, as well as going over the BPD diagnoses. And it was one of those situations where the patient did convey some relief. She did convey to us, you know, this really does fit together. There was not a resistance, there was not anger, there wasn't threat of self-harm, and it allowed us to talk to the patient and her family about what her options were and how to think about it. Now, in some ways, that's a challenging part because access to specific treatments for BPD remained so difficult, even in a major metropolitan area like New York City. The issues of cost and access and waiting lists remain a very serious concern. However, by sitting down with this patient and her family, it's my belief that we were able to guide her family in a way that helped her avoid other really problematic choices in treatment with medications that might not be helpful, nonspecific therapy that wasn't adequately focused on the symptoms, which we felt were consistent with BPD that she was bringing to our attention. And again, I think that it's potentially very liberating for patients and family to have this come into focus and to start to explain why the treatments families had been going to, families had been paying for, hadn't worked thus far. So that's towards the end of my prepared remarks. Is it the question time, Perry, or where are we now?
Yep, no, we're fine for questions. I guess one question that I'm going to ask you, Richard, I haven't thought about it before. Are there other diagnoses that you can say where people don't get the diagnosis up front?
Well, when we looked at the literature, what was clear was that what had been the case in oncology, that had changed almost 100%. Schizophrenia diagnoses had changed really significantly. There was even a change in the thinking of Alzheimer's diagnoses. My sense is that there's still, for different complicated reasons, a barrier to disclosing other personality disorder diagnoses. I think what sets BPD apart is that there's been more intensive investigation, research, and understanding of BPD than most of the other personality disorders. So we have more data that help us guide treatment.
Right.
So that's. But I think that's.
Along with that, then what is typically the personality or other diagnosis that is made if it's not BPD, especially when it's obvious it would be, but
right.
not given due to the stigma because of
right.
the stigma.
So I think this is something that's changed over the decades. From schizophrenia to major depression to post-traumatic stress disorder, I think right now, if there's one diagnosis that I think we often see, it's bipolar, specifically bipolar type 2,
mm-hmm.
meaning no history of frank mania, but episodes of depression. So I think this is something that's that changes, the diagnosis that clinicians make when they're not comfortable making a borderline diagnosis. But right now, I think it's very common for patients to be given bipolar diagnoses, and I think for a lot of different reasons. We have a number of different FDA-approved medications for bipolar disorder. There's a tremendous push to bring awareness of bipolar disorder to the general population. There are advertisements on television, and, of course, there are algorithms for treating bipolar diagnosis, and if anything, right now, I think that's what we more commonly see, as well as other diagnoses in the depression spectrum, but all kinds of things.
Okay, and what would you say are the key distinctions between BPD and bipolar disorder?
I think what the one question that we ask often has to do with mood reactivity. So mood reactivity specifically related to interpersonal experiences. That's what we associate with BPD. So when a patient and family come to us and they say, it seems like our son and our daughter, that his or her mood changes by the hour. Good mood in the morning, has an argument with her boyfriend or his girlfriend, and then angry and provocative in the afternoon. That's much more consistent with BPD. With bipolar disorder, we're going to expect those periods to last days, maybe even weeks, not minutes to hours. So that's if only can ask one question, I try to get that to that issue of mood reactivity.
Mm-hmm. And can a patient have both?
A patient can have both. My understanding from the studies is it's actually not particularly common, but there are certainly some cases, but there's not a common overlap. But of course it's always critical to try to tease apart diagnostically, but it's not a common occurrence.
Okay, and do the conditions get treated with different drugs, or the treatment for bipolar disorder hurt the BPD?
I think that we see many patients who are told they have bipolar disorder, who get the standard treatments for bipolar disorder, specifically the medications, mood stabilizers, atypical antipsychotic medication, they don't respond. They remain symptomatic, and they have the kinds of impairment in functioning, in relationships, and their ability to be at school or work that's very striking. Some of the medications used in bipolar disorder are used for BPD, but again, I think with individuals with BPD, we are going to start with some kind of psychotherapy as the central treatment intervention, with medications used as adjuncts. With bipolar disorder, we're going to much more focus on the medication as the central treatment intervention, with the psychotherapy as an adjunct. Okay,
And if the meds are not working as expected, with the working diagnosis being bipolar disorder, does it mean that the diagnosis is wrong if the medication is not holding, and that perhaps BPD should be considered?
I think that it's very important if the medications for bipolar disorder or for major depressive disorder don't seem to be working, to revisit the diagnosis, absolutely. There are certainly, there are going to be some people who have an accurately made bipolar diagnosis, bipolar disorder diagnosis, who for whatever reason don't respond to medication. But in general, if individuals don't respond to well-researched treatment interventions, then you want to revisit the diagnosis, including personality disorders. And I think that's often what we see at our clinic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If the patient resists the BPD diagnosis, is it so important that he accept it for therapy to work?
I think that's a really a case by case. There certainly are patients who don't, and again, a number of the specific therapies integrate that, but they don't focus on it. I don't think that would mean that that we wouldn't encourage a patient to try and see what he or she can get out of that particular treatment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I think there's potential benefit even when there's disagreement about the diagnosis.
And what do you think can be done to effectively inform and educate practicing mental health professionals on borderline personality disorder?
Well, I think this is a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that more education about the evidence-based treatments, really important. I think more education about the potential benefit to an accurately made BPD diagnosis is very important. But as I kind of pointed out, the resistance comes from a lot of different sides. Again, my experience has been, it depends on a lot of different different kinds of clinicians in the mental health system and their reluctance to think about BPD or to make the diagnosis can be, it differs. Sometimes it's because they think that there should be a medication that can treat a certain condition, and sometimes because they feel it's not consistent with the kind of psychotherapy they practice. So the answer to your question is it depends on which subgroup.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in terms of what causes BPD, is PTSD a common cause? And if so, what age does it generally show up?
So I think that we know that there is a link between trauma and childhood trauma and adult BPD. I think the general thinking is that it's neither necessary nor sufficient, meaning many individuals who have trauma histories don't develop BPD, and many individuals who develop BPD don't have trauma history. I believe the average age of onset BPD is approximately 18 years old, with a standard deviation of 5 to 6 years. So we're looking at late adolescence, early adulthood, I think there's new research on tracking individuals who have trauma histories with regard to the development of adult BPD, but my impression is it's again the same approximate age group in late adolescence, early adulthood, where the patients are first symptomic.
And in terms of the symptoms, if a patient is suicidal, do you deal with the PTSD then? What sort of the frame of the treatment?
In all the treatments that I'm aware of, there are hierarchies of what you deal with, and you deal with safety first. That's always primary, and if a patient is suicidal, that's the first order of business, and investigation and exploration of trauma is always going to be done only when a patient is stable enough to do that. And if a patient's safety is an active concern, then something like exploration of trauma history or treatment for the trauma is put temporarily on hold until the patient is moves from a high acuity to, again, many patients are chronically passively suicidal, but for active suicidality, I think you put exploration of trauma issues on hold until the patient has some kind of stability.
Well, along with that, Richard, I know certainly that's the way DBT does things. Are you speaking also for the other therapies as well?
Well, the what I know best, for example, TFP, that would definitely be their thinking. I don't know with the others that I've mentioned. I'm not as familiar with all the details, but certainly with TFP, that would be the thinking to that they have a hierarchy, just as they do in DBT, and something like safety, suicidality, anything that threatens the treatment, that's addressed first before other issues. That doesn't mean that patients couldn't seek consultation or interventions at the same time. But in something like TFP, as with DBT, there is that hierarchy: the safety first, and then everything follows from that.
Okay. And how do you factor in a professional's concerns of non-coverage by insurance companies as yet another reason for not diagnosing BPD?
That is a very important, and I think that we're really at the very earliest stages, at least in my experience, of having a dialogue with third-party payers about treatment for BPD. But I feel, as a clinician, that it's not helpful for a clinician to put down diagnoses he or she doesn't think a patient has in order to get payment for that. And that's an extra complicating factor. And I think it's a complicating risk management issue for clinicians when they find themselves falling into that. Again, it depends on the payer and the requirements. I think, as a rule of thumb, if you can write down what a patient has, including whatever Axis 1 diagnosis you think the patient might have, as well as the BPD diagnosis, that's potentially most helpful. That's been my experience.
Okay. And then in the spirit of initiating a family intervention, is it ever okay to tell a person with a sibling of someone with BPD or the grown children of someone with BPD that the person has BPD, especially when the person refuses to seek evaluation and treatment?
I think that if you have a relationship if you're consulted by say an adult sibling or your obligation is you do your best with that family member, and you if you haven't examined a patient, of course, you're never on as firm ground as if you've had an opportunity to sit and meet with a patient, but you do your best to reconstruct events and to try to help, whether it's family, siblings or parents or whatever, to come to an understanding of the diagnosis. We do that with other diagnoses, so it doesn't make sense that we wouldn't do it with BPD.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, well, I think that's it. I think we're just about out of time. Richard, thank you so much. I know it's a unique experience to be talking to yourself for an hour or so.
I wouldn't try anything with any ABPD. I think it's doing a wonderful job. So.
Well, thank you. And just I want to remind everybody that we will not have a call-in next Sunday. We'll be in Atlanta at a conference. which I would even say please come, but we're just about sold out, so we can't even encourage you to come. So we'll see you all in 2 weeks. And Richard, again, thank you so much.
Okay,
Take care. Bye-bye.